Hello, this is an extra edition of the SitRep podcast from BFBS because of this somewhat unexpected announcement from the Defence Secretary.
With full backing from our service chiefs, I can confirm that six outdated military capabilities will be taken out of service. These decisions are set to save the MOD £150 million over the next 2 years and up to £500 million over 5 years. Savings that will be retained in full in defence.
Ships, helicopters and drones are going. We'll explain what, why and the difference it will or won't make to the armed forces. No jobs are going. In fact, there are new retention bonus payments to tempt thousands of servicemen and women in certain roles to stay on. And a new military strategic HQ led by the Chief of Defence Staff. All this despite the fact there's still months of work to be done on the Strategic Defence Review. Mike has a lot of explaining to do.
SitRep with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Mike, the explaining is not because you're responsible for this, let's make that clear, but because these look like big changes when there are still big decisions to be made and more big changes to come.
Yes. I mean, in a way, I think these are the easy decisions. The ones that the cuts that were announced yesterday are the easy ones because all of these facilities, all of these things are relatively outdated. I mean, Albion and Bulwark, the two LPDs, the landing platform docks that the Marines use, that's the most painful of them. But that was foreshadowed anyway. The others are, I think, are relatively easy to make decisions. And as John Healy said, there'll be tougher decisions than this to come. And as you mentioned in your introduction, the creation of a new type of strategic headquarters around the Chief of Defence Staff, that is potentially quite a big change. So we are seeing, you know, this Labour government is determined to do defence differently. And the how differently we'll see when the defence review comes out. But these are sort of this is clearing the ground. The cuts that were announced yesterday, more or less, were actually sweeping away things that weren't going to be part of the new force structure in any case.
Okay, so let's run through the list of what is going and then we'll do the detail one by one. In the air, 14 Chinooks and all 17 Puma helicopters, along with 46 Watchkeeper drones. At sea, the Royal Navy's two landing platform dock ships, as you said, Mike, one frigate and two RFA tankers will leave service. Let's start with what feels like the most controversial, as you said, the scrapping of HMS Albion and HMS Bulwark, amphibious assault ships for Royal Marines landings. Since 2018, we've discussed so many times repeated rumours of their impending acts and then ministers saying they'd been saved. A Conservative MP, Julian Lewis, chaired the Defence Committee back at the first time round. Let's hear what he has to say now.
Well, this is a black day for the Royal Marines. And may I advise the Defence Secretary that he'd do well to have a look at the report Sunset for the Royal Marines, which was published by the Defence Committee in February 2018, when the issue of scrapping our amphibious assault ships was described by the committee across parties as militarily illiterate and totally at variance with strategic reality.
But the Defence Secretary told him the Strategic Defence Review will bring a bright future for the Royal Marines and that they had already effectively lost the ships because they'd been mothballed.
They'd in practice been taken out of service, but ministers had not been willing to admit this. Now, our three Bay-class landing ships and RFA Argus, for now, will continue to provide, as they do now, the amphibious capability. This will allow us both to save at least £9 million a year that would have been spent under the previous plans, and it allows us to focus much more strongly on the multi-role support ships, which promise to have a greater capability, a broader range of ability for the future.
So, Micah, is it or isn't it a black day for the Royal Marines?
Not really. It's not really a black day for the Royal Marines, but it is the scrapping of a capability. What we've been saying about the review is that the Ministry of Defence cannot carry on with the same range of capabilities at such low numbers. So we had a capability for amphibious assault, which was based on two ships. And, you know, one of those ships, Bulwark, hasn't been in the water for 7 years. Albion has been out for 1 year, so neither of those ships are available at the moment. But in theory, on paper, we have two ships available for assault, for you know, assaulting foreign coasts. Well, that's a capability that we will no longer have. It can be achieved in other ways, as John Healy was trying to say, but it's not really plausible. So we're giving up that capability for the time being, for the future. Is that bad for the Marines? Well, I'm sure they'd rather have Albion and Bulwark, but remember that they haven't had either of them for some time in reality. And the Marines have got plenty to do. I mean, they're involved in, you know, Arctic warfare. They're involved in rapid insertion. They're involved in the hubs, the manpower hubs that are important around the world, and they're part of our elite forces. So it's not as if the Marines are going to be underemployed. For, you know, quite the opposite. They've got plenty to do. But this particular capability is one that, for good or bad, Britain is now going to give up for the foreseeable future. And of course, you know, people in the Navy will find that really painful. You've got to decide, you know, what might we need for the next 30 or 40 years? And of course, you can never be sure, but the calculation is that amphibious assault is not going to be top of the list when we look at the things that we've got to be able to do to meet our security commitments.
And as you say, the Defence Secretary points to the Bay-class landing ships and RFA Argus as alternative capabilities for Royal Marines amphibious operations. We discussed this back in January when there were rumours of something like this under the last government. Former Royal Marines Commandant General, Major General Buster Howes, compared the capability of those ships with Albion and Bulwark, and he summed it up by saying, "You've got to spit, not dribble. It's something, but it's not the same, is it?"
No, it isn't. That's the point. You can do it. You can adapt to do it. But, I mean, Albion and Bulwark were terrific ships. I mean, I've been on the Albion, not the Bulwark. But, I mean, they're terrific in what they could do and the way they could, you know, have landing craft available and so on. I mean, they're very good. They were very good assault ships. But they were due to go out of service anyway in the 2030s. So they're going out of service now. And they've been up for cancellation, I don't know, two or three times in the last 12 years or so. And the fact that they're not part of the active fleet at the moment tells you something about both the cost of maintaining them and their utility, except in very specific circumstances. So I know exactly what Buster Howes is saying. You know, we'd love to have them, but the fact is, defence has got to be prioritised much more sharply than it has been in the past. And I have to say, you know, previous Conservative governments, because they hate to be seen as weak on defence, were keeping Albion and Bulwark alive for the sake of avoiding a political row, but they were only keeping them alive on paper, not as real ships that could do something useful.
So, Mike, what can't the Bay class do that Albion and Bulwark could?
They can't carry as much, and they can't, as it were, produce the range of capabilities. So, I mean, Albion and Bulwark really are assault ships, whereas the Bay class ships can aid an assault, but you need other things as well. And so, they would make a contribution, but it would have to be a contribution towards a more joint force operation. Whereas Albion and Bulwark, almost on their own, were capable of mounting, you know, a form of amphibious assault.
Another argument we heard in the Commons is, given the state of the world right now, Argus and Bulwark could be taken out of mothballs if needed and made battle ready. How realistic is that?
It's plausible. It depends how much you want to put into defence. But I mean, if they're mothballed, and they are effectively mothballed already, then of course, if we had a great push on them, the hulls are there, the engines are there, you could actually get them moving probably quite quickly. If you're in a war fighting situation, or if you thought you were close to war. But it would require a lot of resource to do it. You know, in the normal course of events, defence would never do that. When you mothball something, you basically lose it. You only really bring it out of mothballs when you're in a state of national emergency and you have to simply throw resources at it.
Mm. Let's look at the other maritime capabilities being retired. HMS Northumberland, a Type 23 frigate, structurally damaged to the point of being uneconomical to repair, according to the Defence Secretary. What sort of jobs would she have done, and how many other ships have we got that will have to share that work now?
Yeah, well, it's a Type 23, but it was due to be repaired not until 2027. And the cost of repair was going up all the time. So it's a bit like, you know, your car gets hit and it turns out to be a write-off for a relatively small amount of damage because of the cost of actually doing the repairs. So, that's another Type 23 we don't have. The Type 26 is on the way. and we are going to have, you know, 8 Type 26s and is it 5 Type 31s in theory, but that's going into the 2030s. So we will miss Northumberland, but I mean, we haven't had Northumberland for some years, and we weren't going to have it until 2027. So I think it means that there's more work for, you know, other frigates. I mean, you know, and the Type 45 destroyers, the Daring class destroyers, we've only got 6 of them, and there's only 3 of them been available recently, but they're working very, very hard. So yeah, it puts a bit of a strain on the rest of the force, and it just shows, you know, I mean, not so long ago, we used to say that 32 frigates and destroyers were the absolute minimum. We cannot get by without 32 frigates and destroyers. Then it was 19. Now it's fewer than 19. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure how many fewer. I mean, we're talking about a very, very small number of frigates and destroyers, and they are the workhorses of the modern Navy. So, yeah, it's we can do things, but we don't have any sustainability because we don't have enough ships and we don't have enough crews for ships to replace them on station when they've, you know, ships have been on station for 3 months, 4 months, they come off station, it's not easy to replace them.
That early retirement leaves at least a 3-year gap until the first of the new Type 26 comes into service. It's another stretch in an already stretched service. That said, we've also talked about, and you just mentioned it, shortage of crew many times. So with Northumberland's company redeployed, does it really make much difference?
May not, because I mean the Navy has a manning crisis or a crewing crisis, so they need to redistribute their seagoing personnel. Those who are rotated for sea, they need to redistribute them in any case. So we can't crew all of the frigates. The few frigates and destroyers we've got cannot be fully crewed at the moment. So you might as well fully crew a smaller number and then work on trying to increase the number over the medium term that we have available. Or, I mean, not necessarily build them all ourselves, even buy them in. You know, it's in times of national emergency, we've often bought ships from elsewhere, just as we sell our own ships to other countries. There are other ships available, of smaller, different class of ships, doing less central jobs. They can be bought in if necessary, but at some point, we're going to have to expand the workhorse element of the Navy beyond, I think, the plans for the Type 26 and the Type 31s. We're going to need more than we've planned for, probably quite a lot more, and I suspect we might end up buying them in. And that, even then, we're going to have a much expanded naval personnel in order to crew them properly.
And just as an aside, Mike, I like the car analogy earlier. Any idea how a ship like Northumberland gets that badly structurally damaged, yet it's only found out during refit? And we know there was an incident in 2020 when a Russian submarine hit her towed sonar, but that alone doesn't sound like enough. She is 30 years old. Could it just be more about age?
Yeah, it's usually wear and tear, and it's usually something in the engines. I mean, the integrity of the hull is not too difficult to do things about. I mean, the hulls get battered around a bit, but you can usually do something about that. It's normally the propulsion, and so it'll be wear and tear. The shafts are extremely expensive to replace, and it's that sort of issue. Or it can be a series of things. When the generators get difficult, the electrical system starts to break down, in the sense that you're repairing it all the time, and there's your jury rigging solutions which end up with a ship that's got peculiar electrics that you think, well, you've got to rip it all out and put new electrics in. So it is very like the car issue, that if we're going to fix it, then you've got to take all that out and replace it. It's not normally the integrity of the basic hull. It's the insides always.
I'd be very happy if my car would last 30 years, I tell you that, Mike. The two wave-class RFA fuel tankers now out of service next year, 3 years early. They were already tied up alongside and not due to sail again anyway. The Defence Secretary says the more modern Tide class have effectively already replaced them. Is it that simple?
Well, Tide class are coming online, and they should be good again if you can crew them. I mean, we haven't got, because the RFA has got industrial relations problems at the moment, they haven't got enough sailors prepared to go under the conditions that they're offered. But you're absolutely right. I mean, RFA Knight, Wave Knight, has been alongside for 7 years, and RFA Wave Ruler has been alongside for 2 years. So neither of them have been in the water in any significant, well, they've not made any contribution for at least over 2 years. And the Tide class support ships will certainly help. But again, we need more of them. And the RFA Fort Victoria, which is the big support ship, which is should go with the carrier when it goes anywhere, is up in, I think it's still in Camelaids in Birkenhead. We're caught in a sort of a dry dock refitting problem, and it's not clear when the RFA Fort Victoria will be available again. And so when our carrier goes out, it needs somebody else's, another country, to support it, which is fine within the NATO alliance, but it shows how threadbare the sustainability issues are, or the Navy is now in terms of sustainability. So the Tide class ships will be are good, they're fine, just old story, we don't have enough of them.
On to helicopters now, and starting with Chinooks, 14 of them being taken out of service.
This acceleration of their retirement will apply to the 14 oldest helicopters in the fleet, of more than 50. Some of those are more than 35 years old, and it means that these oldest 14 will be retired at the point where they are due to enter a costly maintenance package. That will not happen. It means that we can speed up the transition to the new, much more capable Chinooks that will arrive. And it also means that we can save money for defence that we can redeploy to other purposes.
Mike, they are an absolute workhorse for the armed forces, almost a third of the fleet being retired, rather being put into deep maintenance over the next few years. 14 new ones are on order, but they won't start arriving for at least 2 years. Is that manageable?
Well, it's a risk. It's manageable, certainly. I mean, I would worry more if they weren't going to arrive for 5 years or 6 years, but they will arrive in 2 years' time. So, I mean, this is an early replacement. And I mean, what John Healy is saying is, look, instead of keeping these older Chinooks on the books, as it were, we'll just stop spending money on them and we'll take the risk that it'll be 2 years before the new the H-47s come along. I think that's a reasonable risk to take. We're not talking about frontline jet fighters here. We're talking about the Chinooks. They're the workhorse. Everybody loves the Chinooks because they're just so good. It's one of the great aircraft of the 21st century, I think 20th and 21st centuries. I'm not too excited about that. I think that's a reasonable management of the fleet decision to take.
And Puma helicopters, they're all being retired, currently only used in Cyprus to support the country in fighting wildfires, and Brunei for some jungle training. There's a replacement medium lift helicopter, the Airbus H145, on order. This is a capability holiday for at least a couple of years, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And again, the Pumas, they weren't doing anything terribly important. No disrespect to the Puma crews. I mean, but being used in Cyprus and in Brunei, you can replace that with other things. I mean, the job jobs they were doing don't even have to be done by military helicopters. You could have a rental arrangement on civilian helicopters for those sort of things. So again, I think that's a sensible management of the fleet. If we were more well off for helicopters and money to maintain them, you wouldn't need to do that. But in this case, I think in terms of modernising the fleet, I'd be more worried if we weren't going to have the H145 as replacements, but we are, and there'll be a gap. But that gap is not critical to military competence because, as I say, it could be replaced even by renting helicopter time with civilian contractors.
The Defence Secretary says that's how they'll cover the gap.
And that makes perfect sense. Because they're not doing a military job, per se, then that job can be done simply by paying somebody else to do it. Easy.
OK, finally, 46 Mark 1 Watchkeeper drones. Let's hear from the Defence Secretary again.
A 14-year-old drone in an era now, as Ukraine tells us, where drone technology has a life cycle of 2 to 3 months. The Army know what they can do better. They know they can do it more quickly. They know how they will want to be able to focus their efforts for the future. And decommissioning the Watchkeeper Mark 1s will allow them better to do that.
Mike, this one doesn't seem to have caused much controversy in the Commons.
No, I mean, because as the Defence Secretary said, I mean, drone technology is advancing very quickly. So the Watchkeepers are pretty obsolete now in terms of their contribution as drones. But also, it's been a troubled programme. I mean, Watchkeeper has never been a particularly happy technology for various reasons that we don't need to go into. So in a way, it's putting it out of its misery while the Army re-equips with better drones, generally speaking, smaller drones, which can do this, the job much more cheaply and better. So I think that's entirely sensible. WatchKeeper, in a sense, has come to the end of its life earlier than we would have imagined, simply because of the speed of drone technology's development.
Of course, people are an important part of this announcement, Mike. From April, a new £30,000 retention payment will be on offer to around 5,000 tri-service aircraft engineers if they sign up for additional 3-year service. And from January, a new £8,000 retention payment for Army personnel who've served 4 years. It's planned for the next 3 years, and they think around 4,000 soldiers a year will become eligible. What do you make of those?
Yeah, again, these are sensible ideas. Whether the numbers are big enough, we don't know. But, I mean, I think the MOD is trying this to incentivise the sort of the people to stay with the skills we need. I mean, you know, the armed forces aren't just suffering a problem of numbers. It's a problem of expertise that they develop quite expensively and then somebody leaves early. So they're trying to persuade people to stay on longer, to keep their expertise in the armed forces. And that is what we will need. And all of this, you know, Kate, is a presage of the way the defence review is going. This Labour government is determined that our defence will look different as a result of the review. Now, we don't know what the review is going to come up with, but that we've reached, they keep saying, an inflection point, that our defence has got to be not more of the same, not just a more efficient version of what we've done in the past. We've got to transform it into something really quite different for the future. And so all of these are indications of the fact that they are prepared to do that. And some of these decisions are unpopular, but I think at the moment, the MOD under John Healey is indicating that it is going to stick to its guns, but it will be uncomfortable. And as he seemed to say at the end, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Also, a structural change at the top of the forces. The Chief of Defence Staff will oversee a new military strategic headquarters. It puts them formally in command of the individual service chiefs for the first time, and also at the centre of setting priorities for equipment spending. We talked through this very idea with former CDS Lord Richards a couple of weeks ago. He liked it. What difference do you think it will make?
Well, we'll see what difference it makes. In theory, it makes a big difference. In theory, this creates in the MOD a proper military headquarters, not just a management centre of the organisation, but a military headquarters. Because there's been some ambiguity in the past as to whether PGAHQ at Northwood was the military headquarters, or whether MOD was the military headquarters, or the individual service headquarters were the real headquarters. So what this is saying is, no, the MOD will be the headquarters, as you would need in time of war, for instance. But more than that, that the Chief of Defence Staff would have real power over the allocation of resources, over where money is spent. So in theory, the Chief of Defence Staff could take money off one service and give it to another service because of a high priority to develop this or that particular weapon system or capability. Now, that is something that a lot of people said ought to happen, but for all sorts of domestic political reasons, we know never has happened. So on paper, this looks like a big change. Whether it turns out to be a big change depends upon whether the full capabilities of this rearrangement are used, or whether actually it gets watered down in the practice.
Okay, let's finish up by assessing the big picture then, Mike. John Healey, the Defence Secretary, says the capabilities that are being cut will save the MOD about £500 million over the next 5 years. Sounds a lot, but in defence terms, it's not huge. They get to keep that money to spend on things they deem more important. But we are in an incredibly uncertain world right now. Are the capability holidays worth it?
They're worth it if we are replacing them with the capabilities we really need. And I mean, I agree with you, the £500 million over 5 years is really neither here nor there when we are spending £60 billion a year on defence. And even that we know is not going to be enough. So these capability holidays are really, they're holidays insofar as we just need the new equipment as soon as possible. But this is clearing a certain amount of dead wood from the equipment programme in order to make space, not really money, but just to make space for the new stuff that we need to get. And in a way, it's simply to say it's not worth carrying on keeping these things alive on paper. Let's be brave. Let's cut them now so that we can get on with the new capabilities that we really need. All governments say that. Most governments don't really mean it. This government looks so far as if they mean it.
Brave, you said. Given the timing, how risky are the capability holidays, though, do you think?
Well, I don't think there's too much risk involved in this. The capability holidays, say, with the frigates is not a particular problem because these things are not available anyway. What these cuts represent is being more honest about the fact that these things, you know, are not available to us. So stop paying to try to maintain them. Mm. And in that respect, you know, capability holiday isn't really quite the right word. It's the better word would be sensible rationalisation of what isn't working.
Now, our editor originally wanted to call this podcast not the Defence Review, but was persuaded the 1970s comedy reference would be lost. Not on us, I have to say, Mike. Let's set aside the surprise of making such announcements when there is still so much more work to do on the Strategic Defence Review. Do they give us any clue as to what else, good or bad, we might expect to be announced next year?
Yeah, they do. I think we've talked today about the fact that a capability is being cut, which is amphibious assault. We're not going to be able to do it in any meaningful way. And I think when it comes to next year, I think we'll see more capabilities being cut. In other words, the new defence review, I think, will say that we've got to do fewer things better and more credibly. And what those fewer things will be, we don't know. But I think this is what I take away from these cuts is not that they're terrible cuts, because they're not really. Most of them are sensible, but in my view. But what we have seen is ditching a capability, amphibious assault. And I think we'll see more of that next year.
Mike, you know, I have to say, you are the workhorse of SITREP this week. Thank you so much. We're not going to give you a capability holiday. I have to say that. But can you just say that phrase before you go once again? The description you said is a better phrase than capability holiday, because I love that and I want to end on that.
Well, it's not so much a capability holiday as a sensible rationalisation of what is not working anyway. We're not pretending that it's there when it isn't.
Great stuff. Mike, good to speak to you. Good to have you on SITREP with me, as ever. Thank you so much. I have a feeling we're going to be talking about these announcements some more on next week's SITREP, when we should be joined by the new chairman of the Commons Defence Committee, Tan Desi. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye for now.